Chapter 10, The Rebloodlikin Race to the Bottom. I've got to start this section with an admission. Like more and more guys, I experience electile dysfunction. That's defined as the inability to become aroused over any of the choices for president put forth by either party in the 2012 election year. Here's a telling statement that conservative honcho Grover Norquist made at a gathering earlier this year. All we have to do is replace Obama. We're not auditioning for a fearless leader. We don't need a president to tell us in what direction to go. We know what direction to go. We just need a president to sign this stuff. We don't need someone to think it up or design it. Pick a Republican with enough working digits to handle a pen to become president of the United States. This is a change for Republicans. The House and Senate doing the work with the president signing bills. As this book goes to press, it looks like Twit Romney is going to be the man the Republicans end up nominating when their delegangs come together in Tampa Bay for the convention this summer. Maybe we should resurrect the Know-Nothing Party as the slogan of the day? Anyway, Romney is definitely the leader of the pack, and thus the perfect representative of the top 1%. Every politician probably flips as much as they flop, depending on which group they're trying to gather votes from. But in my opinion, Romney leaves you wondering whether a belly flop is as good as the others' flipped lids. Joe Klein in Time magazine put it like this, "Sifting through the Romney policy record in an attempt to find patterns and answers is an act of geology. There are sedimentary layers on issues like abortion, climate change, health care, gun control, almost any issue you can imagine. For example, Romney used to be pro-choice. Today, he believes life starts at conception, and he has become firmly pro-life. Firmly, eh? About the only thing that stayed firm about Romney is his full head of hair, however he pulls that one off. I mean, most of the candidates made a bid for the role of not Mitt Romney, including Mitt Romney. Bill Clinton might have been a pander bear, as one of his opponents said in 92, but here's how Jay Leno summed up Romney. In an effort to clear up his reputation as a flip-flopper, Mitt Romney will give a speech on health care. And then, right afterward, he'll give a 5-minute rebuttal. Would he vote for himself? Dubious. Not surprisingly, the Democrat National Committee has a 4-minute video on this theme at MittyMitt.com. I'm waiting for a flip we can believe in. With the net worth of about $250 million, Romney made his fortune as a Wall Street superstar, a chief architect of the modern executive compensation-driven corporation. That's a nice way of saying what Newt Gingrich put a little more bluntly when Romney told him he should return that $1.6 million he earned from Freddie Mac. If Governor Romney would like to give back all the money he's earned from bankrupting companies and laying off employees over his years at Bain Capital, I would be glad to listen to him. From 1984 to 1999, Romney and his cronies invested in, acquired, and then sold about 150 companies and made a fortune, while hundreds of workers lost their jobs. Vulture capitalism, as Gingrich called it, and for once he was right. The bane of Romney's existence has been mighty kind to him. The last deal he made with his old partners was for a retirement package that's given him a share of the company's lucrative profits since 1999, while adding millions to his annual income. So Romney could have his political cake and eat quite well, too, all without having to seek further gainful employment. Next to Bain Capital, no corporation has been kinder to Romney than Goldman Sachs. That's who Romney went to when Bain was looking to raise dough in 1989 for the Staples office supply company they'd acquired. After he became Massachusetts governor, Romney's blind trust handed Goldman most of his wealth to manage, and it still has at least $10.2 million in Goldman funds, possibly much more, earning as much as $6.2 million. And now Goldman employees are among the largest sources of his campaign money, having contributed upwards of $367,000 as of the end of September 2011. One thing I'll say for him, though, these days Romney's doing all he can to look like a man of the people. He ditched the jacket and tie in favor of blue jeans and plaid shirts. He told a group of people without jobs that he's also unemployed. Yuck, yuck. At the same time, he called for cutting 10% of the federal workforce if he gets elected. You do that through attrition, Romney told some steel workers. The fact is, upwards of 600,000 government workers have already lost their jobs since the recession started. And contrary to what Romney claims, they're underpaid compared to counterparts in the private sector. Remember when Romney said he also made not very much money from speaking? Almost $350,000 in a year. Romney's duplicity goes that extra mile with his calling the federal government's bailout of the auto industry in 2009 nothing more than crony capitalism, Obama-style, a reward for the big donors to his campaign. Well, as it happens, two vulture investors, otherwise known as hedge fund operators, John Paulson of Paulson & Company and Paul Singer of Elliott International, made out like bandits by buying up stock in an auto parts operation called Delphi and then forcing GM to use a heap of its bailout money to shore up the company. They made a windfall of more than $2 billion care of U.S. taxpayers, and now they've each written checks for $1 million to restore our future, the super PAC supporting Romney's candidacy. I can't think of a better example of hypocrisy than this one. Something new came out in March about Romney's old firm, Bain Capital, from which he admitted earning at least $5.6 million from assets to his blind trusts and retirement accounts in 2010, and whose execs and employees are among his biggest campaign contributors. The New York Times reported. In December, a Bain-run fund in which a Romney family blind trust has holdings purchased the video surveillance division of a Chinese company that claims to be the largest supplier to the government's Safe Cities program, a highly advanced monitoring system that allows the authorities to watch over university campuses, hospitals, mosques, and movie theaters from centralized command posts. In the meantime, on Romney's website, the flip side is offered up. Any serious U.S. policy toward China must confront the fact that China's regime continues to deny its people basic political freedoms and human rights. Feel like divesting in Bain yet, Mitt? The big whopper, with extra cheese and Romney's announced fiscal plan, is his announcement that we will level with the American people about what it will take to truly cut spending and balance our budget. As Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone wrote, Romney's call for government entitlement reform actually amounts to this. If we don't cut health care and retirement benefits for old people, how can we pay for the carried interest tax break that allows private equity guys like, well, Mitt Romney to keep paying 15% tax rates? Romney's proposal would cut food stamps $127 billion, which would remove millions of people from the rolls during a downturn and cut the benefits of those who remain. Of course, he wants to repeal health care reform, which he claims would save $95 billion, but would actually raise the deficit by $124 billion in just the first decade. As for his tax reform plan, Romney says he'd make the top 1% pay more of their fair share, but analysts find his reasoning absurd. The overwhelming majority of his $6.6 trillion in tax cuts would go to the rich. The Romney tax cuts, in truth, would be clocking in at a cost of more than $10.7 trillion over the next decade and reducing revenue to a paltry 15% of GDP, according to Michael Linden of the Center for American Tax Progress. Balancing the budget on those terms, as Romney claims he will do, would be next to impossible. I guess, to his credit, and unlike a lot of his Republican brethren, Romney doesn't want to shut down the Departments of Education or Energy. He does want to dump Amtrak, along with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the National Endowment for the Humanities. More drivers, less culture could be one of his bumper stickers. And who are the main men in Romney's campaign? His national finance co-chairman is Frank Vandersloot of Idaho, a billionaire who's also given $1 million to Romney's Restore Our Future Super PAC, somehow avoiding the legal barriers that are intended to keep Super PACs separate from candidates' campaigns. He made his fortune with Melaleuca Incorporated, a wellness company that peddles diet supplements and cleaning products, and has been targeted by Michigan regulators, the Idaho Attorney General's Office, and the Food and Drug Administration for various marketing violations. Vandersloot has been funding various right-wing causes for years. Another one of Romney's campaign stooges is Larry McCarthy, who helps direct Restore Our Future, and his company, McCarthy Hennings Media, has spent $15 million producing and airing attack ads. It's something that comes naturally to McCarthy. He did the famed Willie Horton TV ad on behalf of George H.W. Bush in 1988, which made his rival Michael Dukakis look like he was soft on crime for letting a murderer loose on a weekend pass from a Massachusetts furlough program. Even though the ad definitely went beyond the pale as far as civility, a lot of people believed it. So much for Dukakis' campaign. McCarthy, who calls himself a compassionate conservative, came up with the ads in this year's Florida primary that squelched Newt Gingrich's front-runner status. Romney's leading foreign policy advisor is Elliot Cohen, a neocon professor of strategic studies at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced and International Studies. He is a protege of Paul Wolfowitz, having helped him form the Project for a New American Century in 1997. Pre-9/11, its blueprint laid out in Rebuilding America's Defenses had this clairvoyant line: "The process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor." Right after 9/11, Cohen had a large role in pumping up war under Bush for the big prize, meaning Iraq. Dick Cheney recommended Cohen for a post as counselor to Condoleezza Rice in 2007. The white paper he wrote for Romney urges a policy of regime change in Iran, including possible coordination with Israel on military strikes to prevent the Iranian regime from developing a nuclear weapon. For Romney and the other bloods, war isn't hell, it's good for the economy, stupid. Plus, don't we have to still get back at Iran for seizing our embassy in 1979? In case you could imagine openness in government might perk up under a Romney presidency, here's how columnist Frank Rich summed the man up. "We don't know who Romney is for the single reason that he never reveals who he is. Even when he is not lying about his history, whether purporting to have been a hunter pretty much all my life in 2007 or to being a denizen of the real streets of America in 2012, he is incredibly secretive about almost everything that makes him tick. He has been in hiding through his stints in both the private and public sectors. While his career-long refusal to release his tax returns was damaging in itself, it resonated even more so as a proxy for all the other secrets he has kept and still keeps." Then there's Rick Santorum, the former Pennsylvania senator who's a poster boy for the Christianists. He scored big in the Iowa caucuses with their crowd and came out of almost nowhere to finish first. I guess Iowa was sanctum Santorum. Then, just when Romney looked like he had the nomination iced, Santorum started taking many of the primaries. Now it looks like the nominee may not become clear until the convention. Santorum is a homeschooling culture warrior who likes to brag about fathering 7 kids as though morality can be measured in offspring. Before he got clobbered in a Senate race in 06, he was the congressional poster boy for raking in contributions from lobbyists and their family members. He took in around $500,000, almost 40% more than his closest rival. As Melanie Sloan, executive director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, says, Santorum is portraying himself as this outsider, when he was really the ultimate insider. He worked hard in the Senate to amend a Medicare bill to benefit Universal Health Services, a Pennsylvania-based hospital management company. Months after departing the Senate, he joined their board and garnered $385,000 in director's fees and stock options. He made sure that millions in earmarks went to companies represented by the American Continental lobbying firm, which was one of his contributors, and later on he provided legislative policy consulting services and earned $65,000 from the company. And Consol Energy, a big gas and coal producer that he'd advocated for, hired him on as a consultant. In recent years, as a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Santorum has lived off the far-right gravy train funded by the Koch brothers, Richard Mellenscaife, and others. Some have called this lifestyle wingnut welfare. Santorum does get down to nuts and bolts sometimes. Before the campaign, he was well known for ranting in 03 to a reporter about man-on-dog sex. Woof. However, Santorum says that to put somebody who's a victim of incest or rape through another trauma of an abortion, I think, is too much to ask. The man is a believer in the dangers of contraception in this country. He told an editor with CaffeinatedThoughts.com that it's not okay. It's a license to do things in a sexual realm that is counter to how things are supposed to be. I imagine he had a few extra cups that morning. Recently on Meet the Press, Santorum said that, as soon as he got elected, he'd bomb Iran's nuclear facilities if they refused to open the sites for international arms inspectors. Well, Rick, so far the International Atomic Energy Agency has conducted quite a number of such inspections, but never found a shred of evidence that Tehran's nuclear program has been shifted over into weapons production. Anybody else hear echoes of weapons of mass destruction before we invaded Iraq based on a lie? Of course, Santorum isn't alone in beating the drum for another war. A district judge in New York issued a finding of fact that Iran assisted al-Qaeda in planning the 9/11 attacks, based on some testimony by former members of the 9/11 Commission and three defectors from Iran. What the Associated Press article didn't say was that at least two of those defectors were long ago described as fabricators by American intelligence, and the two expert witnesses verifying the fabricators are ex-commission lawyers who think we're at war with Islam. I seem to hear echoes of another lie that led to our invasion of Iraq. Don't you? We'll get into Santorum's fervent Christianism in a later chapter, but for the moment, here are some more policy nuggets. He'd keep defense spending where it is, but slash $5 trillion out of the federal budget from the EPA, Medicaid, subsidies for job training, energy, education, food stamps, and housing. He'd eliminate most of our finance and regulatory laws. He'd continue to stabilize Iraq, probably by reinvading. In Santorum's words, climate change is an absolute travesty of scientific research that was motivated by those who, in my opinion, saw this as an opportunity to create a panic and a crisis for government to be able to step in and even more greatly control your life. I, for one, never bought the hoax. Wonder if he saw the recent report that about 3.7 million Americans are at risk of catastrophic coastal flooding from sea level rise. But after all, we were put on this earth as creatures of God, to have dominion over the earth, to use it wisely and steward it wisely, but for our benefit, not the earth's benefit. The more energy we consume, the higher our standard of living will be, he believes. I can't resist going on to do a little dissection of Newt. Oh, let me debate him just once, I'd love it. Here's the poster boy for the Occupy Wall Street protesters. Since he left Congress, the gang-rich group, excuse me, of course, I should have said the Gingrich Group, consulting firm has reined in over $100 million in contracts since 2000. That includes $1.6 million from none other than Freddie Mac, the belly-up government-backed housing behemoth. At first, Gingrich said the money derived from his analysis as a historian. I guess that makes some sense, because what does he know about real estate? Then again, what does Freddie Mac need to learn about history? About the robber barons, maybe? Gingrich was selling influence, totally, so he profited personally from the bailout and people want him as their president? Lest we forget, Gingrich left Capitol Hill in disgrace in 1998. He had to resign from the House after he got whacked for ethics violations with a $300,000 fine. Since entering private life, Newt has gone to great lengths to say that he's not a registered lobbyist, except through his for-profit Center for Health Transformation. Clients in the healthcare biz have paid him as much as $200,000 a year to be members. Two dozen of those have been promoted in his center's booklet, and execs have made their pitches from panels on his podium. Gingrich got a rise in the polls after Herman Cain imploded due to ongoing allegations about Yes We Cain in the latest Zippergate scandal. The irony of it all. Newt was now the most palatable remaining choice for family values conservatives, having successfully pushed as House Speaker for Bill Clinton's impeachment over the Monica matter, while at the same time having a 6-year affair with a young intern who later became his third wife, while he was still married to his second wife, who had been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Of course, Gingrich had an affair with the second wife while he was still with the first, after she'd been diagnosed with cancer. Turn the other cheek, Newtie? Turnabout's fair play? Or, as he told the Christian Broadcasting Network, there's no question that at times in my life, partially driven by how passionately I felt about this country, that I worked far too hard, and that things happened in my life that were not appropriate. Listen to that again. Here's a man driven to serial adultery by patriotism and hard work. The fact is that Gingrich has stepped on it so many times that it won't be surprising if he's toast before this book comes out. He told a crowd in South Carolina, where $42,600 is the median household income, that the reason he didn't need to work as a lobbyist was because he made $60,000 for every single speech like this one. Not much of an applause line there. He also came out in favor of getting rid of child labor laws. My copy of the quotable Gingrich has him telling an audience at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, where incidentally I used to teach the most popular class, "It is tragic what we do in the poorest neighborhoods, entrapping children in, first of all, child labor laws, which are truly stupid. Most of these schools ought to get rid of the unionized janitors, have one master janitor, and pay local students to take care of the school." On Face the Nation last December, Gingrich said that activist judges need to be held accountable by being subpoenaed before Congress to explain their constitutional reasoning, and he'd send the Capitol Police or even a U.S. Marshal to arrest them if need be. Separation of powers out the window. A President Gingrich could decide that where the federal courts wrongly applied the Constitution, legislation would remove the power of the courts. Or you could just impeach the judges or abolish their seats. As for those pesky illegal immigrants, Gingrich told an audience that we ought to use UPS and FedEx and send a package to everyone who's here illegally. And when it's delivered, we pull it up in a computer so we know where they are. Wouldn't you already need to know that in order to send them the package? This is the same man who said that unemployed workers shouldn't keep collecting benefits and just sit at home for 99 weeks. It's fundamentally wrong and a violation of the Declaration of Independence commitment that we have the right to pursue happiness. He's also the same man who told the National Review a while back that Barack Obama was actually an undercover Kenyan, like his father, intent on dismantling American democracy. What if Obama is so outside our comprehension that only if you understand Kenyan, anti-colonial behavior, can you begin to piece together his actions? Newt was quoted as saying. In March 2011, Big Thoughts Gingrich gave a speech where he expressed grave concern about what the future might hold for his grandchildren. "I am convinced that if we do not decisively win the struggle over the nature of America," he said, "by the time they're my age, they will be in a secular atheist country, potentially one dominated by radical Islamists and with no understanding of what it once meant to be an American." Wow. You could be a secular atheist and a radical Muslim all at once? Who knew you could mix state and church like that? But damned if he didn't announce a plan to establish on day one of his presidency a commission to examine and document threats or impediments to religious freedom in the United States. But here's my favorite. When somebody at a town hall meeting in South Carolina asked what his position was on torture, Gingrich responded, "Waterboarding is by every technical rule not torture." Waterboarding is actually something we've done with our own pilots in order to get them used to the idea of what interrogation is like. Yeah, Newt, the Navy SEALs did it too, and having undergone waterboarding when I was one of them, let me report to you that it is torture. Gingrich went on to add that a prisoner should be waterboarded at the direction of the president only in a circumstance which the information was of such great importance that we thought it was worth the risk of doing it. And I do that, frankly, only out of concern for world opinion. So in the eyes of the world, waterboarding's a no-no, but not really? Does anybody remember that the United States tried and executed Japanese interrogators for the crime of waterboarding American servicemen during World War II? If Gingrich actually knew anything about interrogation, though, he would realize that it mainly yields false information. But it does make us feel better to torture them, doesn't it? Now, for those of you looking for a solution in the Middle East, here's what Gingrich came up with in an interview with the U.S. Jewish Channel. First, he said that Obama's approach to diplomacy over there is so out of touch with reality that it would be like taking your child to the zoo and explaining that a lion was a bunny rabbit. That's because, in Newt's view, treating the Palestinians on equal footing with the Israelis is favoring the terrorists. Palestinians, you see, are an invented people who are in fact Arabs, and they had a chance to go many places, and for a variety of political reasons, we have sustained this war against Israel now since the 1940s, and it's tragic. Duh. Was there an Israeli state before 1948, and wasn't Palestine there first? When it comes to the Gingrich tax plan, according to the Independent Tax Policy Center, the middle class would be paying higher rates than millionaires. But the non-magnitude of the tax cuts that he's proposing for the top 1% and the corporations would also send the national debt booming still higher, even if federal spending wound up being cut drastically. The analysis says that under the Gingrich plan, the debt would hit $25 trillion, over 100% of our GDP, by the end of his possible second term. That's an additional roughly $12.5 trillion over where we are now. There's no ceiling on a stairway to heaven might be a good motto. Then there are the candidates who fell out of the race early, and good riddance. Maybe it's a sign that there are moderate conservatives who just refuse to drink the Kool-Aid. I don't know. But for dead sure, this was one miserable crew of possible choices. Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, who starred for a short time as front-runner for a day, wrote a book in 2010 called Fed Up. Therein, he said, the American people mistakenly empowered the federal government during a fit of populist rage in the early 20th century by changing the way senators are elected, the 17th Amendment. According to Perry, the states were historically more in control when they decided who those senators were going to be. The 17th Amendment is when the states started getting out of balance with the federal government, is my belief. He'd like to turn the clock back to a time when the rich could easily bribe their way into the Senate by paying off insiders. That's where Perry's fit of populist rage came from, an attempt to bring more democracy into a corrupt system that once let governors and legislators choose our senators, 1789 until 1913. This is also the guy who thought secession was a good idea because of Obama's socialist policies? Excuse me, but didn't we try that once? Rick Perry raised more money than any governor in Texas history, and the cookies from his generous friends cut both ways. Nearly half of the Texas governor's 150 most generous political donors have received business contracts, tax breaks, or appointments from him or his administration. These once included the late Kenneth Lay of Enron fame, who ponied up $87,000 to a Perry campaign and, the day after, saw one of his ex-execs named chairman of the Texas Public Utility Commission. During his 11 years as Texas governor, Perry has taken free trips, 200 flights worth $1.3 million, from corporate execs and other big-money donors. Texas does have this amazing pay-to-play culture, as one political consultant put it. Are we surprised at Perry's flat tax plan, calling for a 20% across-the-board rate, which would give high-income folks a big break and everybody else modest tax savings or none? Perry was scary. There's no other way to put it. He used to hunt and take guests to a West Texas camp that his family leased. The name for part of the property, on a rock at the entrance as late as the 80s and 90s, was Niggerhead. He's poo-pooed evolution as just a theory that's got some gaps in it, and accused scientists of making up man-made climate change so that they will have dollars rolling in their pockets. If truth be told, the pseudoscientists who've made out like bandits are the ones being bankrolled by the oil and coal companies to say that the jury's still out on global warming. Representative Michelle Bachmann, who I'm not proud to say hails from my home state, thinks the Founding Fathers worked tirelessly to end slavery. In fact, many of them owned slaves and enshrined slavery in the Constitution. We've come a long way, baby. On national TV, Bachmann accused President Obama of planning a trip to India at a cost to taxpayers of $200 million a day. Of course, she also thinks the Prez has virtually no one in his cabinet with private sector experience. Only about two-thirds of them. She also believes global warming science is a hoax. CO2 is a natural byproduct of nature, and that the EPA ought to be rechristened the Job-Killing Organization of America. Don't lose sight of Bachmann having introduced the Lightbulb Freedom of Choice Act of 2011, after those anti-free marketeers like George W. Bush's administration set out to ban incandescent bulbs as harmful to our environment. On abortion, she said, the Republican Party cannot get the issue of life wrong. It's a seminal issue. I think she might have misstepped on that one. Did she mean to say seminal? After all, she's got 23 foster kids. Speaking of seamy situations, we should recall that Romney once took a family vacation to Canada with his Irish setter, Seamus, strapped to the roof of the car. Herman Cain at least let it be known what his campaign was really all about, calling his book, This is Herman Cain, Shoot from the Lip Cain, as he said of himself at one press conference, coming at you. While in charge of construction of the Pillsbury skyscraper in downtown Minneapolis, he was the self-described CEO of self. He said he'd left the Democratic plantation a long time ago, going on to run Godfather's Pizza and the National Restaurant Association, where he apparently encountered a bevy of beauties. His 999 tax plan would have raised taxes on about 84% of American households, and the lower your income, the more you'd have paid. But if you earn more than $1 million a year, your tax bill would have been cut in half. No more capital gains taxes whatsoever. Oh, and like Gingrich and Bachman, Cain didn't think waterboarding was torture either. I watched quite a few other Bloodlicken debates and have got to say they could be the pilot for a new reality show called Gang Survivor. Or maybe reruns of The Gong Show or Beat the Clock. Obama has naturally been the prime target. Romney purported that Obama is going to put free enterprise on trial. Please, Obama goes out of his way to praise it. Gingrich said Obama favors higher taxes, more regulation, no American energy. Perry accused Obama of waging a war against religion. Rick Santorum said Obama plans to take wealth and redistribute it to others. John Huntsman Jr. said Obama's time in office has been full of crony politics. Michelle Bachman was determined that he be a one-term president. But their true ways with words come in the pointing of fingers, no middle ones allowed, at each other. Romney outspent Gingrich 5-1 in Florida on negative ads, which basically poisoned the atmosphere to the extent people hardly give a damn. If all the political bullshit encourages you not to vote, you've then given your rights away. Except they like it if people don't vote. They want you to feel that you don't make a difference because then you're easier to control. Who amongst them would snatch defeat from the jaws of victory in 2012? That was the question raised by Paul Krugman in a column headlined, Send in the Clueless. He pointed out just what level of absurdity these politicians have achieved. I mean, Obama's health reform package, designed by the Rebloodlicans for the most part, gets denounced as another big government maneuver. And the president, who apparently took out bin Laden, is a radical socialist who is undermining American security. Taking the oath of office is one thing. But what's amazing is that only one of the Rebloodlican candidates, John Huntsman Jr., refused to sign any of the pledges that various interest groups are asking for. And look what happened to him. Early dropout. Rick Santorum and Michelle Bachman even signed on to the marriage vow pledge, I doubt if Newt was asked, where candidates agree they're opposed to same-sex marriage and reject Sharia law, but will ever remain true to their spouse. This pledging business began with Grover Norquist, who over time has gotten 95% of all Rebloodlicans in the Congress to say unequivocally that they will never, ever raise taxes. Can loyalty oaths be far behind? Can you see why a man could experience erectile dysfunction? Chapter 11. This is your Tea Party on Coke. When the Tea Party showed up on the scene not too long after Obama won the presidency, they cast themselves in a mold that a lot of Americans could relate to. Starting with the name, of course, calling to mind those patriots in disguise who boarded British ships in Boston Harbor and dumped all those barrels of tea into the sea in protest of the colonial tea tax back in 1773. It's interesting that the tea the Brits were trying to force down their throats was from the British East India Company, BEIC, that London had set up as a monopoly when the BEIC was having some hard times. The message was, buy BEIC tea or the King's Army will spread freedom all over you. They figured they'd blockade Boston Harbor until it was all drunk and taxed and paid for. Good to the last drop. So this was really a protest against one of the original corporate bailouts, and it helped jumpstart the American Revolution. Americans have never really gotten along with the billionaire's wet dream of government-enforced monopoly, even from the beginning. So here came all these folks at the modern-day Tea Party rallies, dressed up as George Washington and marching with flags reading Don't Tread on Me. The motivation behind the Tea Party seemed at first like a valid one. Its members were against how much power the big corporations have, and how the politicians are so willing to bail them out in exchange for having their own pockets lined. They were determined to downsize the government, a grassroots movement that was ready to take back the country at the polls in 2012. They knew how corrupt the two-party system had become. In the 2010 midterm elections, the Tea Party did surprisingly well. In today's Congress, we have 15 freshman House members as part of the Tea Party caucus, and they've been making out quite well, donation-wise, from some very familiar Washington outfits. Their first 9 months in Congress, the 15 all told received more than $3,450,000 from about 700 different PACs. The biggest contributor, 52 donations, was Honeywell International, a Fortune 500 defense contractor. Coming in second was the American Bankers Association, followed by Koch Industries, the National Association of Realtors, and Lockheed Martin. Now, you could argue that nobody in politics today has much choice except to keep an open hand, which goes along with a closed mind. Greasing of palm is, after all, the favorite parlor game in D.C. To compete, any party is going to have to corrupt itself, which is why I don't support any parties, including the teabaggers. Also, when people like Glenn Beck end up being the spokespeople, I almost view them as worse than what we've got. Is the Tea Party concept initially a good idea? Absolutely. Follow the Constitution. Follow the Bill of Rights. We've strayed so far from those documents that we do need to come back to them. But maybe in the name of that, there's something insidious going on here. At least that's where the evidence is pointing. The trouble is, supporters of the Tea Party are, whether they're aware of it or not, snorting coke. Don't take it from me, but from a memo the Mitt Romney campaign dated October 4, 2011, and first revealed by the Washington Examiner, stating unequivocally that the Koch brothers, yes, that's pronounced Koch, are the financial engine of the Tea Party. The same memo went on to discuss Romney's courting of the billionaire bros, Charles and David. They'd endorsed Romney in 2008, and one of Twit's first big campaign fundraisers for 2012 was hosted at a Koch mansion in the Hamptons. But the Kochs aren't hedging their bets. They're planning on hosting whoever might emerge over tea, and we're not talking herbal. Until August 2010, when a 10,000-word article by Jane Mayer appeared in The New Yorker, the Koch family of Wichita, Kansas, and Planet Earth had been operating under the radar forever. Primarily from the oil business, they'd amassed quite a sizable fortune, to the point that each brother is worth between $21.5 and $25 billion. The brothers own almost all of the $100 billion Koch Industries, a conglomerate of refining, pipeline, chemical, and paper businesses. Along with owning Georgia Pacific, they bring us Stainmaster carpets, Brawny paper towels, and other consumer products. There's an online boycott if you're interested. Theirs is the second biggest privately run company in America. Forbes has listed the Kochs as the nation's fifth richest people. Their father, Fred Koch, was one of the founders of the John Birch Society, so it's no big surprise that the boys are estimated to have given more than $100 million so far to right-wing causes. They put up the seed money for the Cato Institute and the Mercatus Center and are big donors to the Federalist Society. Not to mention donating directly to 62 of the 87 members of the House GOP freshman class, and to 12 of the new members of the U.S. Senate in 2011. And fronting groups called Americans for Prosperity, Freedom Works, and Citizens for a Sound Economy, along with about 30 others, including Tea Party affiliates. Things go better with Koch, I guess. Freedom Works, led by ex-House Majority Leader Dick Armey, who gets $500,000 a year from the group and its foundation, set up a Tea Party commission in 2011 to give presentations on how to cut the budget deficit. Freedom Works also founded Tea Party Patriots, another grassroots group to stop any tax hikes on the rich from being part of the deficit deal. Freedom Works for who? I don't think they're talking about the working class. So just what is the Tea Party in favor of? Small government? Anti-regulation, tax cuts, removal of government programs like Medicare, Social Security, and Obamacare. What are the Koch brothers in favor of? All that and a bit more. To keep their oil and gas business booming, they've reportedly given about $55 million since 1997 to scientists and others to say that global warming is a hoax. Koch Industries and its employees form the largest block of oil and gas industry donors to members of the new House Energy and Commerce Committee, topping even ExxonMobil. And what do they get for that largesse? As a down payment, the House budget bill not only reduces finances for the Environmental Protection Agency, but also prohibits its regulation of greenhouse gases. As Mary Boyle of Common Cause put it, what makes them, the Kochs, unique is that they are not just campaign contributors. They are a vast political network in their own right. One group the brothers have been courting with arms outstretched is the Christian right. Tim Phillips, president of the Koch-funded Americans for Prosperity, showed up not long ago to present at the Awakening Conference sponsored by the Freedom Federation. So conservative Christian voters are being told that a radically limited federal government is God's idea, and that right-wing economic policies are mandated by the Bible. Jesus himself is also opposed to progressive taxation, the capital gains tax, the minimum wage, and even collective bargaining. I guess that old parable about money changers being tossed out of the temple has been relegated to the biblical bin of dust. The Kochs are also cozy with two of the Supreme Court justices who pushed for the Corporations Are People resolution in the Citizens United case that overturned almost a century of limitation on contributions to political campaigns. In fact, Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas took part in strategy sessions at the Kochs' annual retreats before ruling on that case. The Kochs have also funded a campaign to help Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker with his union busting. There have been petitions gathered with over 1 million signatures from Wisconsin citizens calling for a recall election that would get rid of Walker. Meanwhile, Americans for Prosperity, funded by the Kochs, is busy running $700,000 worth of TV ads in Wisconsin claiming Walker's policies are working, even though the state has been losing jobs consistently since the Walker budget came to pass. It's called the Stand with Walker campaign, and they don't mean pushing yourself around to keep your balance. Supposedly, this kind of coordinated effort between candidates and independent groups like Americans for Prosperity is a violation of IRS law. Under the Internal Revenue Code, all Section 501(c)(3) organizations are absolutely prohibited from directly or indirectly participating in or intervening in any political campaign on behalf of or in opposition to any candidate for elective public office. Contribution to political campaign funds or public statements of position, verbal or written, made on behalf of the organization in favor of or in opposition to any candidate for public office clearly violate the prohibition against political campaign activity. Violating this prohibition may result in denial or revocation of tax-exempt status and the imposition of certain excise taxes. Is anybody out there willing to mount the Koch challenge? You've probably heard about the controversy over the Keystone XL oil pipeline, which drew a slew of protesters to the gates of the White House. At the writing of this book, it's still on hold. In January, Obama rejected rapid approval of the pipeline because the Republican Congress was holding a short-term extension to the payroll tax cut hostage to it. Obama said the arbitrary nature of a deadline prevented the State Department from gathering the information necessary to approve the project and protect the American people. Before this happened, Speaker John Boehner and George W. Bush had called the pipeline a no-brainer that would create tens of thousands of jobs right away, if you believe in the Tooth Fairy, and Mitch McConnell said it was shovel-ready, and he's a champion shoveler of you-know-what. They're talking about a 1,700-mile, $7 billion project that would bring very crude oil from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, down through the Great Plains states to be refined on the Texas Gulf Coast. Besides polluting air and water and destroying wildlife, it's set to cross the Ogallala Aquifer, which provides drinking water for 2 million people and supports $20 billion in agriculture. Parts of the pipeline will also be built on an active earthquake zone. So what happens if there's a leak? Not to mention this being business as usual in terms of fossil fuels, while we ought to be making the shift to a cleaner energy economy. According to James Hansen, a prominent climate expert with NASA, if this development isn't stopped, it's game over for the global climate. Removing and burning all that oil would send so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that it'd be impossible to stabilize in future years. Plus, most of the Keystone oil is actually for export, not for U.S. energy independence. But in a classic case of the fox guarding the henhouse, Hillary Clinton's State Department was allowing a Keystone XL contractor in Houston, chosen by the TransCanada company that plans to build the pipeline, to manage the project's environmental review. And TransCanada's top lobbyist in Washington is Paul Elliott, who happened to have been a deputy national manager for Hillary's 2008 presidential campaign. As soon as she became Secretary of State, he got hired by TransCanada. It turns out that he's so tight with folks in the State Department that one of them provided 4th of July party invitations, subtle coaching and cheerleading, and inside information about Secretary Hillary Rodham Clinton's meetings to him. What's so different about this from when Dick Cheney held secret meetings with Big Oil during the first months of the Bush administration, which offered them pretty much anything they wanted? Like the phrase from Latin class goes, "Cui bono?" Who benefits from all this? None other than the brothers Koch. They stand to make millions from the pipeline's construction since they run a subsidiary called Koch Exploration Canada LP and are admittedly among Canada's largest crude oil purchasers, shippers, and exporters. They're spreading the word to state legislators about such matters through the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, ALEC, by sending out model bills promoting their agenda. ALEC only makes the details available to its 2,000 legislative and 300 corporate members. One of these tries to refute all the evidence about climate change. Another model would cut various regulations and public services and is called, don't laugh, the Economy Civil Rights Act. ALEC bills itself as the nation's largest nonpartisan, individual, public-private membership association of state legislators. That's a mouthful, which ought to raise eyebrows from the get-go. It was founded back in 1973 by conservative activists like Paul Weyrich, and today ALEC is intent on privatizing education, breaking unions, and passing voter ID laws. Nobody knows just how much money the Kochs have given ALEC, but it's sure to be more than $1 million. ALEC's current chairman is now the Koch brothers' top lobbyist. And in return for $25,000 a year, Koch Industries gets to be an equal board member among ALEC's state legislators. A footnote on all this: if you want to talk real jobs, not just more money to the rich, the power plant upgrades that need to happen because of the new rule curbing mercury emissions will create at least 45,000 temporary construction jobs and 8,000 permanent ones. The loan guarantee programs that the Department of Energy has in place for solar and wind, and companies working on more fuel-efficient cars and advanced battery technology would mean more than 60,000 direct jobs. And that's just for openers. Once a year, like clockwork, the Kochs bring together some of America's righteously richest for a secret strategy seminar. In June 2011, this was held in Bachelor Gulch outside Vail, Colorado, at a Ritz-Carlton. Mother Jones magazine reported, "Though the Vail guest list is a jealously guarded secret, the Koch network includes Rich DeVos, co-founder of Amway, owner of the Orlando Magic, and a prolific donor to Focus on the Family and other conservative causes. John Childs, a notoriously media-shy Boston private equity guy who's worth an estimated $1.2 billion, and who last year doled out $750,000 to outside expenditure groups like Karl Rove's American Crossroads. Diane Hendricks, a billionaire roofing supply magnate who joined the Kochs in supporting Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's recent attacks on public sector unions. They and a few hundred more listened to talks on, among other things, winning the fight between free enterprise and big government. Charles Koch gave acknowledgement to 32 individuals and families who had given more than $1 million each in the past year to the Kochtopus, what political insiders call the network of advocacy groups the brothers have employed in their discreet attempt to shape American political life to their whims. What came out of that gathering at Coney Island? Well, at least in the backroom closets, they surely discussed the Koch brothers' plan to have a national database to connect up millions of their like-minded citizens. Apparently, the Kochs started the voter file with $2.5 million back in 2010. It has been given the name Themis after the Greek goddess who imposes divine order on human affairs. Themis will, in effect, become an electoral role of right-wing America, allowing the Koch brothers to further enhance their power base in a way that is sympathetic to but wholly independent of the Republican Party. Charles, 75, and David, 71, are no spring chickens, but they've obviously got plenty they're planning to squeeze in while they're still kicking. Like Charles told his Masters of the Universe at Bachelor Gulch, you can't make this stuff up. This is the mother of all wars we've got over the next 18 months for the life or death of this country. We'll see what happens in 2012 to the top freedom-loving advice they gave their 50,000 employees just before the midterm elections. They all received an urgent letter instructing them who to vote for and warning them about the dire consequences to their families, their jobs, and their country should they choose to vote otherwise. Let freedom ring. When the Kochs convened their four-day retreat early in 2012 at a golf resort in Indian Wells, California, helicopters, private security, and police officers from neighboring cities patrolled the area constantly. Every entrance to the Esmeralda Renaissance Conference venue was blocked. A number of private planes belonging to wealthy Rebloodlican donors flew into a nearby airport, including one that belonged to billionaire investor Phil Anschutz. Coming for the first time to a Koch event was Sheldon Adelson, the billionaire casino tycoon who's primed to be the most super Pac-Man of them all. That is, if the Koch brothers don't beat him to the punch. Yup, the Tea Party bills itself as the protector of our Constitution, which they claim was established to restrain our federal government. It's hard to figure out what document they're reading, since the real text of the Constitution leans heavy on ensuring that the new government had enough power. The framers thought the old Articles of Confederation were way too weak. What the government can do, not what it can't, is what the Constitution tries to define. The 10th Amendment leaves whatever powers aren't enumerated in the Constitution to the states. So maybe the Tea Party is confusing the Constitution with another document? Perhaps the Bible? I read one article about a whole bunch of patriots coming to a seminar, only to find out that supposedly the Constitution is based on the Law of Moses and restores the 5th century kingdom of the Anglo-Saxons. Besides that, they look at Social Security, the EPA, and the 1964 Civil Rights Act as violations of God's law. The story goes that the Tea Party began when Rick Santelli of CNBC got on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and called for the traders to hold a Tea Party to stop Obama's proposal to subsidize the losers, meaning folks who couldn't keep up with their mortgage payments. That same day, the Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, put a Tea Party page on Facebook and started organizing events, whereby a whole bunch of angry, God-fearing, government-loathing, populist insurgents fired up the town halls. This is actually the biggest AstroTurf campaign in history. Passing itself off as a spontaneous uprising of concerned Americans, it's a completely fabricated grassroots movement. In 2009, Tea Party organizers reported back to David Koch at their Defending the Dream Summit. 5 years ago, Koch told the gathering, my brother Charles and I provided the funds to start Americans for Prosperity. It's beyond my wildest dreams how AFP has grown into this enormous organization. Here's the irony of it all. The Koch brothers wouldn't be bankrolling the Tea Party except for the money made by the old man in Stalin's Soviet Union. He had just graduated from college with a degree in chemical engineering. And in 1929, with a partner named Winkler, Fred Koch signed a $5 million contract, a ton of money in those days, to become Comrade Stalin's number one builder of oil refineries, five altogether. 4 years later, Koch had declared $500,000 in the midst of the Great Depression, and that was the original source of all the family's assets. The communists loved Koch's refineries and sent a number of engineers to be trained in Wichita, Kansas. Later in the mid-1950s, after a final trip to the USSR, the old man started talking about a commie conspiracy to take over our country. According to son Charles, all the engineers who'd worked with his dad had ended up imprisoned by Stalin, which turned Fred into an anti-communist who thought the values of economical freedom and prosperity were more important than ever before. I don't know about you, but I'm feeling a little coked up right now. When the Tea Party was stolen by the same party system that's running the show, the next thing we got was Occupy Wall Street, which hasn't been captured because it refuses to participate in the political process. The great evil, to me, is that the party system can buy out the righteous anger people have for the way the system works.